Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology, and he's an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Francine and Lynn welcome Dr. Stacy Stein. Dr. Stein is assistant professor of medical oncology at Yale School of Medicine, and she joins us this evening for a conversation about GI malignancies. Here's Francine Foss.
Let's start off by having you tell our audience a little bit about what got you interested in this whole area of GI malignancies.
Well, I recently finished my fellowship, and I found that some of my most challenging and rewarding patients to take care of had GI malignancies, and I also found a great mentor who does research in GI malignancies, and the combination of the two led me to pursue this field.
Stacy, what sort of different gastrointestinal tumors do you see? Tell our listeners about what GI tumors are.
So GI tumors in total encompass a lot of different areas. We take care of patients with esophageal cancer, gastric cancer, liver cancer, pancreas cancer, and colorectal cancer.
Can you talk a little bit about the whole issue of cancer in the GI system? I think that's one of the easiest areas to find cancer because we look in there with scopes.
You know, so colon cancer, we have an excellent screening tool for. There are many screening tools. One of the most widely used is colonoscopy. And so all people should be getting screening colonoscopies starting at the age of 50. And sometimes younger, if they have a family history, they should talk to their primary care doctor if they should be getting screened sooner. It is an excellent screening tool. We're able to then diagnose people at an early stage, which allows us to achieve a cure. Unfortunately, though, for many of the other GI cancers, we do not have good screening tools, and we're working on, you know, finding screening tools that we could use, because for many of the cancers, like pancreatic cancer, for example, unfortunately, we often don't diagnose someone until the cancer is more advanced and therefore not necessarily curable.
Aside from a family history, what are some of the risk factors for these various cancers?
So that's a very good question. So we do know of a few risk factors. One is obesity, and that's been found now in many cancers to be a risk factor. Interestingly, while the rates of some cancers are going down, the rates of some cancers are on the increase in the United States because of obesity. And specifically for GI cancers, one of those are cancers of the esophagus. We're seeing more of those at the area where the esophagus meets the stomach. We call it the G junction. And there's an increase in those cancers, and part of that is due to the increasing rise of obesity in this country. Another cancer that's been impacted by increased rates of obesity is liver cancer. So worldwide, liver cancer is most often caused by hepatitis viruses. But in the United States, obesity is becoming a more common risk factor for liver cancer.
Stacy, can you just define obesity? A lot of us are a little bit overweight, but when you say obesity, are you talking about kind of morbid obesity? And at what level are you at increased risk for developing these GI cancers?
Well, so the way doctors define the word obesity is by something called the BMI or body mass index. And that looks at a patient's height and weight. And basically, someone who has a BMI of over 30 is obese, and that puts them at increased risk. And then even higher numbers for the BMI define morbid obesity.
And with regard to the esophagus, how about alcohol and smoking?
Yeah, so those are very important risk factors, especially for esophageal cancer. For colon cancer, which is the most common cancer that we treat, there probably is a small increased risk with smoking, although it's not as tightly associated as with other cancers like lung cancer. And also, diet is a risk factor. So diets that are higher in fruits and vegetables and lower in red meat are diets that are associated with a lower incidence of colorectal cancer.
Are there other dietary issues that we should pay attention to?
Well, so there are some things potentially on the horizon that may be interesting. There is a lot of research now in looking at vitamin D levels and risk of colon cancer. It's unclear now what the recommended dose should be. It might be significantly higher than what the recommendations are now, but I would say that that's still an area of research.
And can you just comment on the issue of barbecued foods and processed foods like hot dogs and things that may potentially have carcinogens and that we're told are bad for us?
So there probably is an increased risk with those foods and the rate of cancers, especially in the GI tract. Fresh fruits and vegetables, you can't get enough of those in your diet. And staying away from processed food, food with nitrites, and overall just decreasing red meat intake would be a more healthy lifestyle.
What are some of the challenges that we face in treating these various malignancies? Presumably GI cancers, the esophagus versus the pancreas versus the colon. Tell us about prognosis, equal stage for equal stage. Why do some areas seem to do better than other ones?
Yeah, so, that's a good question. Some of it has to do with the ability to screen. So for colon cancer, for instance, when patients are found to have cancer on colonoscopy, that's usually in an early stage. So the way we define it, there are four stages, and basically the higher the number, the greater that the disease has spread. So in stage four cancer, that means that the cancer has spread outside of the organ that we're talking about. And unfortunately, when a cancer is diagnosed at that stage, we often cannot achieve a cure because it's not curable with surgery. So the earlier we can find the tumors, the better the prognosis. And unfortunately, many of the symptoms that are associated with early stages of these cancers are very nonspecific, meaning that when someone's diagnosed with advanced pancreas cancer, sometimes they'll say that they just felt a little bit of bloating, maybe. Maybe they had a little bit more constipation. Maybe they felt like they were full a little bit earlier before they finished their meal. But they're so nonspecific that a doctor may not necessarily do a complete screening workup when a patient has those symptoms. And so it would really be great if we had, other tests like a blood test or something in the future that we could look at to define who's at higher risk maybe to have some of these screenings. It's very important to know your family history, because if someone has a strong family history of these cancers, then we would do, in some instances, more invasive tests on a routine basis, such as if someone has a strong family history of pancreas cancer, sometimes now we do routine scopes to take a look, to look for early stages of disease. Because unfortunately, often when it's found, it is no longer curable. And that's a much bigger challenge to treat.
Can you talk about some of the other diagnostic modalities, such as things like MRIs and PET scans, and how they might be helpful to make the diagnosis?
Yes. Yeah, so usually, if someone has symptoms, they will have some kind of imaging modality to find the cancer. And sometimes that often starts with a CAT scan. But we do use other modalities. part of it also is when we're making a diagnosis, we need a biopsy. And so we do then do other tests to help get the biopsy. For colon cancer, that's often a colonoscopy. For esophageal cancer, we could do an endoscopy where a scope is put down the throat, and then biopsies could be obtained from that. Also from the pancreas, they could do something, the GI doctors do something called an ERCP, where they put a scope down and it can actually get over to the pancreas to take a biopsy. Sometimes we do that just with imaging. We call it an MRCP because it's an MRI of that area of the body, and we could get a better look at where the tumor is.
So is it common to get that needle biopsy at the time the patient has the procedure, the diagnostic procedure like the scan, or do you oftentimes come back later? Because I know in breast cancer, it's common when a woman goes for an ultrasound of a lump to actually get a biopsy done at that time.
Right. So it depends what the test is that the person is having. If it is some kind of scope, then obviously we always try to get a biopsy at the time of the procedure. If they see anything abnormal, and they will take multiple biopsies to see if there is any cancer in that area. You know, if it's an imaging test like a CAT scan, then usually the results would come back to that patient's doctor, and then the biopsy would be scheduled at a later time.
Now, these procedures that we've discussed, the grand majority of these are outpatient procedures, so the patient does not have to sleep over in the hospital. Is that correct?
Correct. And actually, I would say that in general, for all of the treatment that we do, we try to make everything an outpatient procedure. When patients come see us after they've been diagnosed and when they're receiving chemotherapy, this is pretty much, for us, all outpatient. When patients come to us, they're able to get their blood work done, see their doctor, and get their treatment all on the same floor in one day. And almost everything is done as an outpatient. We try to make it convenient.
If we're doing a biopsy on an organ, say, like the liver or the pancreas, for example, where we can't get a scope to a location where we can see something abnormal on a scan, is that a situation where we might do something called a fine needle aspiration? And what is that procedure?
Yeah, so we like to get a big of a biopsy as possible in general, but some areas of the body are harder to get a biopsy. So a fine needle aspiration means that a doctor, often an interventional radiologist, by using imaging, gets to the area that we're looking at that we want to biopsy with only a small needle, and we get just a little bit of tissue for the pathologist to look at. And often it is enough to make a diagnosis. When we can, though, in other areas, we like to get a larger sample. Part of that is because the diagnosis is made by a pathologist looking at the tissue. They make slides of the tissue that they have. But often we like to have certain staining done to give us more information. And now in the era of personalized medicine, there are often different genetic tests that we would like to perform on the sample to get a better understanding of maybe what the mutations are that cause this cancer and possibly direct our future treatment. So when possible, we like a bigger biopsy, but sometimes because of the area such as the liver or pancreas, we do get a fine needle aspiration.
So, Stacy, you alluded to this earlier, but can you just take us through the process? A patient gets a biopsy done, and it shows a GI cancer. How do they actually get into your multimodality clinic at Yale?
So we have a group together, basically, their primary care doctor would contact us. We're usually able to get appointments for new patients within 1 or 2 weeks. We like to see people as soon as possible to get them information about their diagnosis and what future tests we need to complete our staging workup and start discussing treatment as soon as possible.
We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about GI malignancies with Dr. Stacy Stein.
Breast cancer is the most common cancer in women. In Connecticut alone, approximately 3,000 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer this year and nearly 200,000 nationwide. But there is new hope for these women. Earlier detection, non-invasive treatments, and novel therapies provide more options for patients to fight breast cancer. In 2010, more women are learning to live with this disease than ever before. Women should schedule a baseline mammogram beginning at age 40 or earlier if they have risk factors associated with the disease. With screening, early detection, and a healthy lifestyle, breast cancer can be defeated. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as Yale Cancer Center, to make innovative new treatments available to patients. A potential breakthrough in treating chemotherapy-resistant breast cancer is now being studied at Yale, combining BSI-101, a PARP inhibitor, with the chemotherapy drug irinotecan. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by the Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Lynn Wilson, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Francine Foss. Today we're joined by Dr. Stacy Stein, and we're discussing GI malignancies. Stacy, in the first part of the show, you had mentioned the term personalized medicine. Go ahead and please describe that in a bit more detail.
Well, so what we're finding out in GI oncology and really across the board in all cancers is that because a cancer comes from a certain organ, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're all the same. What we're trying to get at with personalized medicine is what mutation is there in a gene that caused this person to have this cancer? And can we find a treatment then that is tailored to that mutation, to that specific pathway that isn't working properly in those cells to give targeted treatment? And in GI cancer, I could give you a couple of examples of how we're doing that. So there are two antibodies that are used for some patients that have colon cancer called cetuximab and panitumumab, and they both target something called the EGFR, or epidermal growth factor receptor. And initially, pathologists were looking to see if this receptor was expressed in tissue, and then those patients were given those two drugs in a few large clinical trials. And it turns out that there's a gene called KRAS that is mutated in about 40% of patients with colon cancer. And it was found then, looking back on all the patients in these trials, that patients who had a mutation in that gene did not have any response to cetuximab or panitumumab. But the patients that had the wild type or normal KRAS gene often did have some kind of benefit from getting those drugs. And so now we routinely look at all patients who are diagnosed with colon cancer for their KRAS gene status, whether they have a wild type gene or mutated, and then we make treatment decisions based on that. There's another gene called BRAF, which is mutated in about 10% of patients with colon cancer, and it appears that those patients also do not respond to those drugs. Another example is that there is a protein called HER2, which has been widely used in screening breast cancer patients for use of the drug Herceptin. And in breast cancer, there have been huge strides in improving patients' response and survival with chemotherapy when they have an overexpression of the HER2 protein and they receive the drug Herceptin. Well, a group found that about 20% of patients with gastric cancer also have an overexpression of the HER2 protein. And there was a trial done where those patients were given the drug Herceptin in combination with some of the more traditional chemotherapy that we use. And it was found that they had a benefit in how long they lived when they received the Herceptin with the other chemotherapy. So that is another example of personalized medicine, where we can look at the initial biopsy someone has and check for the expression of these different proteins and then tailor the treatment. And hopefully this is just the beginning of many advances that we'll see in the future of targeting treatment to that person's tumor.
So should most patients with these GI cancers nowadays expect to get those assays, and are most patients treated in this personalized medicine approach?
Yes. And at Yale, we are screening all of our patients for these mutations.
So can you also talk a little bit about another interesting pathway in cancer, which is the angiogenesis pathway? And we've heard a lot about this in the context of other kinds of tumors. Is that relevant in GI cancers, and do you use angiogenesis therapies in these settings?
Yes, it's very relevant. So there's been a lot of interest in looking at angiogenesis in cancer development. Because when a tumor gets to be beyond a certain size, it really needs its own blood supply to continue to grow. And so it's been thought for a long time, if besides just stopping the cancer cells from being able to divide and grow, if we could stop the ability for the tumor to have its own blood supply, that we could also really target tumor growth. And there is a drug called bevacizumab that targets this pathway, and it's been tested in multiple cancers, and it has been found to have benefit in patients that have metastatic colon cancer, that it does provide benefit when combined with chemotherapy. Unfortunately, we also looked at the combination of bevacizumab with drugs in the adjuvant setting, meaning patients that have an earlier stage colon cancer, where we give them some chemotherapy after surgery to help reduce their risk of having a recurrence of the disease in the future. And there was a large trial that people were very excited to see done, looking at the addition of that with chemotherapy in these patients. And while it looked like maybe it delayed some patients being diagnosed in the future, unfortunately, it did not seem to decrease the number of patients that eventually recurred. So we're still working on figuring out what the role is for some of these drugs in our treatment.
What are some of the treatment options that are available for these various cancers, and how are those coordinated together or combined?
Well, so at Yale, we have a multidisciplinary team that meets every week. It is combined of the medical oncologists, the surgeons, radiation oncologists, radiologists, and pathologists. Also, some of our social workers come, people from the high-risk clinic, and we all get together and discuss our new cases. We can look at the pathology up on a screen together. We look at their imaging studies, and we discuss what the best treatment approach is for each patient. And it's really great to be able to have that as opposed to, you know, making phone calls to different people. It's nice to have everyone in the room looking at everything together and really putting their heads together. So I think that that's a big benefit of coming to a large institution for treatment. And we do, you know, often discuss what the sequence of treatment should be and what treatments are available. Often that is determined by the stage that of the disease the patient has when they're diagnosed. Whenever possible, we hope to incorporate surgery for curative treatment. But we do work in a multidisciplinary team and often discuss the patients there.
And what about the role of radiation therapy in these diseases?
So there is a role in some of these diseases for radiation therapy. For rectal cancer, that is a large part of the treatment effect. Usually when patients are diagnosed, if they have local disease, before we do the surgery, we often give chemotherapy and radiation together. And then the patient has surgery. And often that can allow the patient to have a smaller surgery, which helps preserve their rectal function after the surgery. Also in esophageal cancer, radiation plays a large role in the treatment. And there we often also give chemotherapy and radiation prior to the surgery.
What are some of the things that have changed in a positive way, or advancements that have taken place over the last 10 years? You mentioned some of the personalized medicine drugs that have been developed, but what's your sense of where we've been over the last decade?
So I would say that there have, you know, been advances in every area of GI cancer. I'll give you a few examples. So a couple of years ago, there was a drug approved for liver cancer, which was the first drug that really showed a survival benefit, called sorafenib. And there's a lot of active research looking at new drugs for liver cancer. So it's nice that we now have a systemic treatment available when local treatments have failed for liver cancer. Also, I would say the use of the targeted therapies in colon cancer, such as the antibodies cetuximab and panitumumab, and also bevacizumab for targeting angiogenesis. In pancreatic cancer, which has notoriously been a difficult cancer to treat with chemotherapy, recently there was an advancement of using a three-drug regimen, all drugs which had been used previously and are used in colon cancer, using in combination that has shown a survival benefit over a standard drug that we had been using for a while, which we still use, gemcitabine. You know, I would say that there have been achievements in all areas of the diseases we treat, but there's certainly room for improvement. And I think that, you know, with increased research in the pathways that are involved, hopefully we'll be seeing new drugs in development.
Well, that leads me to my next question, which is, what is the role of clinical trials in this disease, and do most patients actually go on a clinical trial initially at the beginning of their treatment, or are the clinical trials usually after they failed their original treatment?
So that's a great question. So clinical trials are very important. They dictate all of the decisions that we make now. All the treatments that we use now are based on previous clinical trials. So it's really invaluable. Often the clinical trials that we have are for later stages of disease, but I think that there are still important questions to be answered even in the curable settings, because we have, you know, for instance, in colon cancer, we know that a certain percentage of people will eventually have a relapse. So there's ongoing research in those areas too. But many of the clinical trials we have open are for what we would call second line therapy, meaning after someone has initial treatment and has progression of their disease, then we try to have trials open in every setting for patients to be able to enroll.
Since we've had some advances in the last 10 years, are we seeing that translate into better prognosis for some of these diseases?
Yes. Yes, we do. Specifically for colon cancer, which is has the highest incidence of all GI cancers, we've seen a big benefit. Now the overall survival, or how long people live even after they've been diagnosed with metastatic disease, has increased significantly over the last couple of decades. Initially, we had only one drug, 5-FU, to treat patients with. And since then, there have been other new drugs, oxaliplatin, irinotecan, cetuximab, panitumumab, bevacizumab, and hopefully newer drugs down the pipeline. And so, you know, all the changes have been incremental, but when you look over the span of the last few decades, you can really see that there have been stepwise improvements, and it really gives me hope that we're going to continue to see more improvements in the future.
So as more patients are living longer and longer with GI cancers, do you have an active program at Yale focusing on issues of long-term follow-up for these patients and survivorship issues?
Well, we do. So we follow all of our patients after they've finished receiving treatment for what we call surveillance, where we continue to do physical exams, check blood work, and sometimes do imaging at certain time points. And also, one of my colleagues, Dr. Tara Sanft, has started a survivorship clinic here, which combines the use of nutritionists and physical therapists and social workers and other people interested in this area to help follow our patients even after they've been technically cured of their disease, to make sure that they're getting all of the other medical care that they should be and dealing with any long-term issues that they still have, maybe side effects from the treatment that they received in the past.
Dr. Stacy Stein is Assistant Professor of Medical Oncology at Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions or would like to share your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.